Hey everybody. It's time for something genuine. Yay. Dawn, I sent you those recordings. I assume that you got them. Yay, good. Thank you. And I actually wrote them down before I joined you guys. Tonight we're going to listen to Dan Ariely on how to change your behavior for the better. Now, before we start, I will remind you that you're probably going to want to take notes. And Don's trying to save us bandwidth. I can't remember those legal technical announcements to make. No, it's all good. Thank you, Don. So anyhow, I want to remind you guys to just jot down a few notes so that when it comes time to discuss this, we'll have the opportunity to do that. And I will remind you, you know, you have the notes to remind you. I want to remind you also what we're doing here. We are listening to the real world experience of real world people who arrive at conclusions that are pretty close to the ones that we arrive at in our spiritual milieu. Ooh, big word. but anyhow, and tonight it's a little, we're taking that even a little bit further because you may listen to this guy for a while and go, number one, what the heck is he talking about? And number two, what the heck does this have to do with anything that we do? but it does, and it relates to what we talked about this morning about reprogramming our consciousness. So this guy obviously didn't know it when he gave the talk, but I think it's insightful, and I think that we can connect the dots and that it will be very productive. So let's see. Seemed like there's one thing. Oh, there was one more thing I wanted to say. George, it looks like you have been in bed all day long. Because no. You're sitting in, I assume that's a day bed at the place where you're staying in Florida, but it looks like a headboard. So I saw you in bed this morning with that headboard behind you, and I see you in bed this evening with that headboard behind you. So get your lazy butt up and do this work. Anyhow, all right. Don, without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to you to play Dan Ariely on how to change your behavior for the better.
I'm badly burned. Most of my body is covered with scars, including the right side of my face. Just don't have hair. That's just how it happened. Looks symmetrical, but almost. Anyway, now that we discussed facial hair, let's move to social science. And in particular, I want us to think about where is the potential for humanity and where we are now? And if you think about it, there's a big gap between where we think we could be and where we are. And it's in all kinds of areas. So let me ask you, how many of you in the last month have eaten more than you think you should? Just kind of general, okay? How many of you in the last month have exercised less than you think you should? Okay, for how many of raising your hands twice been the most exercise you got today? how many of you have ever texted while driving? Okay, we're getting honest, let's stress your honesty. How many people here in the last month have not always washed your hands when you left the bathroom? A little less honest. By the way, it's interesting how we're willing to admit texting and driving, but not washing our hands. That's difficult. We can go on and on. And the problem in the topic is that there's lots of things when we know what we could do. We could be very, very different, but we're acting in a very different way. And when we think, how do we bridge that gap? The usual answer is just tell people. For example, just tell people that texting and driving is dangerous. Did you know? It's dangerous. You should stop doing it. And you tell people something is dangerous and they will stop. Texting and driving is one example. Another very sad example is that in the US, we spend between $700 and $800 million a year on what's called financial literacy. And what do we get as a consequence of that? There was recently a study that looked at all the research ever to be conducted on financial literacy, what's called the meta-analysis. And what they found is that when you tell people, you teach them financial literacy, they learn and they remember. But do people execute? Not so much. The improvement is about 3 or 4% immediately after the course, and then it goes down. And at the end of the day, the improvement is about 0.1%. Not zero, but as humanly close to zero as possible. So that's the sad news. The sad news is giving information to people is just not a good recipe to change behavior. What is? Well, social science have made lots of strides, and the basic insight is that if we want to change behavior, we have to change the environment. The right way is not to change people, is to change the environment. And I want to present a very simple-minded model of how to think about it, and it's to think about behavioral change in the same way that we think about sending a rocket to space. And when we think about sending a rocket to space, we want to do two main things. The first one is to reduce friction. We want to take the rocket and have as little friction as possible, so it's the most aerodynamic possible. And the second thing is we want to load as much fuel as possible to give it the most amount of motivation, energy, to do its task. And behavior change is the same thing. So let's first talk about friction. In this particular case study I'll tell you about, there's a pharmacy, an online pharmacy. Imagine you go to your doctor, you have a long-term illness, your doctor prescribes to you a medication, you sign up for this online pharmacy, and you get your medication in the mail every 90 days. Every 90 days, medication, medication, medication. And this online pharmacy wants to switch people from branded medication to generic medication. So they send people letters, and they say, please, 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 switch to generics. You will save money, we will save money, your employer will save money. And what do people do? Nothing. So they try all kinds of things and nothing happened. So for 1 year, they give people an amazing offer. They send people a letter and they say, if you switch to generics now, it will be free for a whole year. Free for a whole year, amazing. Right? What percentage of people do you think switched? Less than 10%. At this point, they show up to my office and they come to complain. Why did they pick me? I wrote a couple of papers on the allure of free. In those papers, we show that if you reduce the price of something for, let's say, 10 cents to 1 cent, nothing much happens. You reduce it from 1 cent to zero, now people get excited. And they said, look, we read these papers on free, we gave free, not working as we expected, what's going on? I said, you know, maybe it's a question of friction. So what do you mean? I said, people are starting with branded, they can do nothing and end with branded. To move to generic, they have to choose generic over branded, but they also have to do something. They have to return a letter. So this is what we call a confounded design. Two things are happening at the same time. It's branded versus generic, but it's doing nothing versus doing something. So I said, why don't we switch it? Why don't we send people a letter and say, we're switching you to generics? You don't need to do anything. If you want to stay with branded, please return the letter. Right? What do you think happened? Lawyers happened. It turns out this is illegal. By the way, for brainstorming and creativity, doing things that are illegal and immoral, it's fine, as long as it's just in the brainstorming phase. But this was the purity of the idea, right? Because the initial design was the brand that had the no-action benefit. In my illegal, immoral design, generic had the no-action benefit, but they agreed to give people a T-intersection. Send people a letter and say, if you don't return this letter, we will be forced to stop your medications. But when you return the letter, you can choose branded at this price, generic at this price. Now, people had to take an action, they were on even foot, right? It wasn't that one had the no action benefit. What percentage do you think switched? The vast majority switched. So what does it tell us? Do people like generics or do we like branded? We hate returning letters. This is the story of friction. Small things really matter. And friction is about taking the desired behavior and saying, where do we have too much friction, so it's slowing people down from acting on it. And every time you see that the desired behavior and the easy behavior are not aligned, it means we want to try and realign them. That's the first part. We talked about friction. Now let's talk about motivation. In this particular study, we were trying to get very poor people in a slum called Kibera in Kenya to save a little bit of money for a rainy day. You know, if you're very, very poor, you have no extra money, you live hand to mouth, and from time to time, bad things happen. And when something bad happens, you have nothing to draw on, you borrow. In Kibera, people can draw, it sometimes borrow, it sometimes at up to 10% interest a week. And then, of course, really hard to get out of it, right? You live hand to mouth, something bad happens, you borrow, things get worse and worse and worse. So we wanted people to keep a little bit of money for a rainy day. And we thought about what is the motivation, what is the fuel that we need to add? And we tried all kinds of things. Some people, we texted them once a week and said, please try to save 100 shillings, about a dollar this week. Some people, we sent a text message as if it came from their kids. So it says, hi mom, hi dad, this is little Joey, whatever the name of the kid was, try and save 100 shillings this week for the future of our family. Right? I'm Jewish, a little bit of guilt always works. Some people got 10%. Save up to 100 shillings, we'll give you 10%. Some people got 20%. Some people got also 10% and 20%, but they got it with loss aversion. What is loss aversion? Loss aversion is the idea that we hate losing more than we enjoy gaining. Now think about somebody who is in a 10% condition and they put 40 shillings in. They put 40 shillings, we give them 4 more. They say, thank you very much. That person gave up 6. They could have gotten 6 more, right, if they gave 100, but they don't see it. So we created what we call pre-match. We put the 10 shillings in the beginning of the week. We said, it's waiting for you. And then if somebody puts 40 in, we say, oh, you put 40 in. We're leaving 4 and we're taking 6 back. So in both cases, pre-match or post-match, people get 10%. But in the pre-match, they see the money they did not match leaving their account. So we have text from kids, 10%, 20%, pre-match, post-match. And we had one more condition. It was a coin about this size with 24 numbers written on it. And we asked them to put the coin somewhere in their hut and every week take a knife and scratch the number for that week. Week 1, 2, 3, 4. Scratch it like a minus if they didn't save and scratch it up and down if they saved. Now think to yourself, which one of those methods do you think worked the best? Text from the kids, 10%, 20%, beginning of the week, end of the week on the coin. I'll tell you what the average people think, right? We've done these studies of prediction, both in the US and in Kenya. People think that 20% will get a lot of action, 10% less, the rest of it will do nothing. Kids, coin, doesn't matter. People think loss aversion would have a small effect. What actually happens? Sending a text reminder once a week helps a lot. Good news, this program lasted 6 months, people forget. Reminding people is great. 10% at the end of the week helped some more. Financial incentives work. 20% at the end of the week, just like 10%. No difference. 10% in the beginning of the week helps some more. Loss aversion works. 20% beginning of the week, just like 10% in the beginning of the week, no difference. And the text message from the kids was just as effective as 20% plus loss aversion, which is amazing. Right? It's amazing how motivating messages from kids were, and one conclusion is we don't use kids enough. Right? And of course, I don't mean in a child labor sense, but if you think about parents and their kids, we are the best that we can for our kids, and we think about the future, and I think we should think about how to use that amazing source of motivation to get parents to behave in a better way. But the big surprise of the study was the coin. The coin basically doubled savings compared to everything else. And now the question is why? What was it about the coin? So I'll tell you how I started thinking about the coin and then we'll come back to it. So you know, when I do research on, let's say, buying coffee, I don't need to go anywhere. I can sit in my office, I bought enough coffee, I know how it works. The details, I'm familiar with them. When you do research in some of the poorest places in the world, you have to go and visit and see what's going on and get some insight about how the system works. And on that particular day, I'm in a place called Soweto in South Africa, and I'm sitting in a place that sells funeral insurance. You know, in the US, people spend crazy amounts of money on weddings. In South Africa, it's funerals. People spend up to a year or 2 years of income on funerals. And I sit in this place and... Oh, by the way, before you judge the South Africans as being irrational, with this. I just want to remind you that with spending a lot of money on funerals compared to weddings, at least you know for sure you only have one. Okay, so I sit in this place that sells funeral insurance, and this guy comes in with his son. His son is about 12, and he buys funeral insurance for a week. It will cover 90% of his funeral expense only if he dies in the next 7 days. Right? These are very poor people. They buy small amount of insurance and small amount of soap and so on. And he gets that certificate, and in a very ceremonious way, he gives it to his son. And as he gives it to his son, I think to myself, why the ceremony? What is this father doing? Now think about the breadwinner that decides on that particular day to direct some money into insurance or saving. What is the family going to see tonight? They're going to see less, right? At that level of poverty, there'll be less food, less kerosene, less water, something less tonight. And what his father was doing and what our coin was trying to do is to say, yes, there's less food on the table, but there's another activity. You see, what happened is that there are many good, important economic activities like saving and insurance that are invisible. And now the question is, how do we make them visible? So let's go back to our rocket model. We have to, first of all, look at the system and see where there's little things we can fix with friction. Where can we remove friction? And the next thing we want to do is we want to think broadly about the system and say, what other motivations can we bring in? And that's a much more difficult exercise, and we don't always know what would work best. Is it going to be money? Is it going to be loss aversion? Is it going to be something that is visible? We don't know, and we have to try different things. We also have to realize that our intuitions sometimes mislead us. We don't always necessarily know what would work the best. So if we think about this gap between where we could be and where we are, it's a really sad thing to see this gap and to think about it. But the good news is there's lots we can do. Some of the changes are easy, some of the changes are more complex, but if we'll attack each problem directly, and not by just providing more information to people, but trying to change the friction, add motivation, I think we can. Can we close the gap? No. But can we get much better? Absolutely yes. And thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Don, for playing it. Appreciate it. Yeah. So now you know why I gave you the little preamble. You may be wondering what the heck this has got to do with anything that we do. Don's like, y'all. Fair enough. George is like, I don't know. It's great. Well, I will say, Kathy came in and said, let's see, I'm looking at my paper. I shouldn't be. I should be looking at the chat box. Yes, she said friction equals resistance. Don's like, financial class. No, what about financial finances? Exactly, although that was the example that he used. He says, let's see. So the question is, how do we bridge the gap between having the knowledge, like texting while you're driving is a bad thing, and the behavior. People still text while they drive. You know, there are more and more accidents all the time. Yeah, I like more of a joke, too. But really, how do we bridge that gap between knowledge and action? And, you know, when we were at the retreat, Regina said, most of you won't put these tools into action. And in fact, when I was at the retreat, I'm like, you know what? This is fabulous. You're giving us everything we ever needed to know to wake up. It's just the puzzle pieces are fitting together in a slightly different way. But if I already knew everything I needed to know to wake up, why am I not awake? Well, maybe, and you could argue all day long, maybe I am. But maybe you couldn't argue all day long. That'd take about 3 seconds, right? But no, seriously. I mean, we get all these tools. We get them a lot. And yet, we don't put them into place. And so the question is, why not? What is peculiar to the human psyche that keeps us from doing what we say we desire? And I think his talk went to address some of that. Don, Cassie, Connie's getting up too. She may. Well, are you going
to
say
when
something?
When it comes to awakening, it, like for instance, repeatedly, this even happened earlier because I'm like an ongoing theme of questioning all my thoughts. Literally, I have this record playing in my mind now, but it's taken me years. Okay. Of is it true? Is it absolutely true? And why don't we do this? I'll tell you right now, because to do this work, you got to be brave because stuff comes up. And I'm talking sadness. I'm talking feelings that feel tumultuous. And I got to, this is going to be breaking. I don't even know to speak this out loud, but I just have to because it recently just happened. I had a memory, and it's funny because the lesson today is that the past is over. It can touch me not, right? That's, of course, the miracles lesson. So I was playing with my hair and just being goofy and silly during the break and going like this and I made a mustache. And then all of a sudden I had this memory. This sweet, precious memory of Alex, 5 or 6 years old, sitting on my lap. And he loved to play with my hair because my hair was mostly done and always long. And he would do that. He would take my hair and he would make a little mustache. Like that. And I started feeling so, so sad, like instantaneously. I remembered my lesson, you know, the past is over, it can touch me not. But something wanted me to, like, go deeper. Because all this sadness just kept, was coming up. Like, this just happened during the break, you know? And I started asking Holy Spirit, I'm like, what is this? Why is this, you know, why is this feeling here? What is this about? And then all of a sudden, I thought to ask this question, and this is going to seem absurd, just absolutely absurd. But something in me said, wait a minute. Is this love I'm feeling? Is this just love? Is this just love? And I got really, really quiet. I didn't want to assume if it was or wasn't. Okay. So I just sat there and I tried to get as quiet as I could, just letting Holy Spirit speak, not Dawn. And I said, I mean it, Holy Spirit. I don't care what the answer is. I just want the truth. I don't care if it's a yes or no or whatever. And I just sat with it and I sat with it. And I just kept going deep and asking Holy Spirit, is this true? Is this what this is? This feeling that I'm feeling that feels, it feels like sadness. It feels like it could even be depression. And then I asked Holy Spirit and the answer I got was, and I couldn't believe it. It's literally blowing my mind. The answer was yes. So I'm like freaking out. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? How many times have I felt this feeling of like sadness and misinterpreting? Talk about confusion. Talk about how the ego takes a certain feeling or whatever and totally misinterprets it. Okay, because this feeling isn't a comfortable feeling. And then, but once I understood and I could see what Holy Spirit was trying to show me, is this for me? This for me, I'm not going to speak for anyone else, but for me, this is how love is showing up. And the second that I got that, like something just lifted. Something was just like, oh my God, for 20 years, I have been mislabeling love. I have been giving love and how it shows up in me a name that it is not. I've been calling it something it isn't. And that is how I've been incredibly confused, incredibly wrong. And to see that was like, it literally is still like, I like almost making me shake inside. Like it's rocking my world in a way. I had no clue. And so one of the questions that really helped me to see it differently was also our loving all method. Because I was like, because these feelings are just so raw and so powerful. And then I was like, well, can I just accept it? And I could feel it. The answer was an emphatic yes. I was like, if I felt this feeling for the rest of my life, I could do it. I really could. And I meant it with every fiber of my being. And I think that's also what would help me get to the other side, to get through it, to really, and not really beat myself up too, because there was a little moment where the ego tried to reassert itself and come back in and see, look how stupid you were. You didn't even know what love was this whole time. And you had it all along. You had it all along. And then look what you did. So what I would say is the reason why we don't do this whole spiritual thing is because of what it brings up. And we're so confused. We're so confused about so much of these raw energies coursing through us. And we think they're an enemy, and they're anything but that. So, yeah, that was my sharing.
And it was a good one. Thank you, Dawn, for sharing. That's really helpful. Yeah. Yeah, and there's no question that this feared look is a big part of it. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else want to share on this? Bonnie, are you raising your hand?
You're just framing your pretty face.
All right, Connie, please share.
Yeah, I think basically what I have to say is pretty much an extension of Don's, which Don did quite well. Yeah, I remember some time ago, maybe at Endeavor Academy, I'm not sure where we were talking about people appearing not to do things or having resistance. And it being labeled, laziness. But they said the fact of the matter is that we just don't see our own self-worth enough to bother to do it.
Interesting. Wow. That's interesting. welcome, Marge. Yeah, and he identified the two things, and we talked about these things again this week in retreat. He said it's like sending a rocket into space, and that we want to do two things when we do that. We want to reduce friction. We want to reduce our resistance, and the second is we want to load as much fuel as possible. So we want as much motivation as possible. I mean, it just makes sense with what we've said here. We talk about carrying our spiritual aspiration out in front, and the aspiration is going to be, I want to awaken. I have to believe that it's possible, or I'm not going to do it. I'm just not going to do it. Why waste my time that way? If I don't believe that awakening is possible, I'm not going to do it. And that's what I just heard you say, Connie. And I liked that he put it at one point, it's about doing something versus doing nothing. And that was a point that I was attempting to make this morning about, running on autopilot. How do we make ourselves do something? How do we change our attitude, reduce our resistance, and increase our motivation to do these things that we've been told work? We have proof worked. We know people. Regina, for example, who's had great success with these tactics. So, and one of the barriers to that is, okay, well, Regina can do it, but I can't, but maybe I can't do it. And again, that goes back to what Connie was saying, Dawn, which by the way, is not true, but Dawn.
One thing I can think of is that there's two different motivating factors I know happening in my journey. One is the suffering. It has gotten so intense when I believe a thought that isn't true. So that's one factor that is extremely motivating, because I'm like, this hurts way too bad. I don't want to believe this anymore. So let me look. Let me see what is the truth. And then the other amazing thing is when I do get that peace or that relief or that bliss or that happiness, and it's like building that muscle every time. It's like scratching that coin. Every time I get to a turnaround and I say, oh my God, wow, I can actually breathe now. And it really literally feels like some ginormous heavy weight just came off of you. And so it's just like that perfect analogy. And that's my coin and I'm scratching it every single time. So like I'm literally building a muscle. So somehow like the neural network is starting to alert me like, hey, this is something you want to do. You know, yes. That's my gold. Like what Jay was talking about earlier in our fellowship time. That's the gold right there. When you get to that turnaround and you can feel the relief and the power in that. And one more block to the awareness of love's presence is let go. I mean, that's huge. That is, and so I feel like that, those two sides of the coin are both motivating factors for me. Both the carrot and sort of kind of the stick.
Yeah.
It's not really a stick, but it does seem like that in the time.
I think suffering's a big stick. Yeah. Absolutely. I think you're 100% right about that. I also thought it was really interesting. He talked about loss aversion. He said, what does that mean? He says, we hate losing more than we enjoy gaining. That's what loss aversion is. That's how we're built. And we got this voice we've been listening to, depending on how old you are, 50 some odd years, saying, you know, you better take this action or you're going to lose. Right? You better take this action or somebody's going to, you know, mistreat you or get yours or, you know, before you can get it or, you know, whatever these false thoughts are, it's law. That's, you know, gloom, despair and agony on me, right? Those are the thoughts that ego runs on. Those are the thoughts in the subconscious. And those are the thoughts we listen to. That's how we're built. I'm afraid if I don't do what ego's telling me to do, I will lose. And I sure as the hell don't want to lose. So you can tell me about how wonderful it is on the other side all day long, but I'm not losing. Just go to Disney World. What?
And you know, I mean, we all know, everybody here knows the premise from A Course in Miracles is that sense of loss. I mean, that sense of not enough, the ego's dictate of more, more, more. And it's always something external to oneself that's temporary, even the Disney World stuff or the, you know, the 8 under. It's temporary, every single piece of it. And so to keep, you know, just to keep that in mind, enjoy that temporary experience, but remember the truth before that. Rest in, you know, what's eternal beyond the glimpses of, you know, the good stuff, I guess you might say. And when Dawn was talking earlier, you know, why do we do this? Why do we keep in the same loop? You talked about that this morning, Jacqueline, the loop. You know, those habit energies and that that absorption from the time that we're up to 7 or whatever it is, that most intense of times. I was reflecting on that when you were saying that, Jacqueline, because I certainly know part of my conditioning was my Catholic upbringing and going to church 6 days a week, you know, before school and then on Sunday for years until I was like 13 years old. And so hearing that same loop in that sort of a context. But we were the family that walked out of church and, you know, the kids were killing each other, you know, on the way home in the car. It wasn't like there was any, you know, true meaning to what was going on in an action sort of a way. It was demonstrated to be just the opposite of that. It was just that obligatory filling our responsibility, guilt. I'm bad and therefore, you know, it's important that I'm there so that I can, you know, redeem myself somehow. you know what I mean? But for me, I mean, personally, I can only speak for me. It had a, you know, a much deeper impact beyond the conditioning. There was an inherent love for God for me. I don't know how else to say it. And to this day, that's what keeps me going. You know, people talk about enlightened, becoming enlightened, and all. I never even considered that the whole time I was studying A Course in Miracles, for instance, and that was 30 years. I didn't ever think about or ponder or get bent out of shape over this idea of enlightenment. We talk about it more here in Awakening Together, certainly, than any place else I've ever, been. And it still isn't a big deal to me. It just isn't. It just isn't. Loving God feels like enough.
Sweet.
Loving myself feels like enough.
Sweet.
I don't know. That's all I'll say. I'll give up the mic.
Yeah, that's really sweet. Thank you, Kathy. Dawn.
In specific response to your question about why we operate from lack and respond to that, it's because this world is literally built on the collective insane ego, which that's what the ego is. It's the idea of separation, which is the idea of lack or loss. So what ends up happening, and especially this guy, because he's talking to like mainstream, you know what I mean? So quote unquote, normal consciousness.
Yeah, normal.
But
normally insane.
When we get the fear of loss and fear itself, it does have a component that arises in the body. Everybody knows the adrenaline. The adrenals kick in. And that does at times feel very energizing. It can make you get out of the way of a moving car or to, you know, you've heard women, you know, their babies hurt and they can literally lift a car, you know.
Yeah.
I haven't personally done that, but I'm just saying, you know, you hear these stories of what adrenaline can do, but the adrenaline comes from fear. So the fear makes you, like for instance, I'll take myself as an example. When I was growing up in school, how my I am bad belief played out was I was always afraid to make bad grades. So I always wanted to make good grades so that I didn't get in trouble, get beat. So I didn't want that spanking. So I was afraid of getting punished. So I would do the very thing that I was told to do, that I should do. And it was literally the adrenaline that would push me to do what I needed to do. But there comes a time in your life, or at least it did for me, where it's like, good God, I'm done being a slave to this fear. This is exhausting. And literally it comes at times where you get old enough in years where your adrenaline glands have had enough of this output of all that. So it's taxing the body. But I think a lot of people act from lack and attack because it's that ego mindset. And you do get that little jolt of adrenaline, but oh my God, to do it from spirit instead and make that choice and do it from inspiration. That is so much better and there are no side effects. So I love that part.
No, that's great. Kathy?
I was also thinking after your sermon this morning, how insidious the subconscious aspect is, in that the habit energies are. For me, part of my religious upbringing was you were taught not to question. I mean, if you questioned, it was like blaspheme, you know, it was, and you know, little kids, I mean, when you're growing up, when you're young and you're under the, you know, guidance of a nun, and they're not always nice. Yes, how dare you question my authority, exactly, Dawn. and I was one of the kids that you, that did, because I had a lot of questions even when I was young, and that didn't go over well. And so there's that conditioning too, where when you inquire this inquiry idea, when you inquire, you know, you kind of get that no inquiry. You simply accept what is. And now here we are all these years later, back to that very thing, accepting what is. How odd is that? How what kind of a loop is that? How crazy is that? But for me, what I felt I was being asked to accept didn't feel like truth. And I just couldn't swallow it. I just couldn't do it. And so that made trouble for a little kid that was expected to go along with the status quo. And I don't know, maybe that's has something to do with like why inquiry even now is, I don't know. It's uninteresting to me for some reason. That seems like such a weird thing to say. You know, what, well, like you were talking about this morning, watching the mind, watching what passes through the filter of my mind and discerning where to focus my attention. It's a constant thing. It's constantly going on. It's like there's something right there with all of it, but uninvolved. And gratefully, like a calmness about it, no matter what's showing up, not getting absolutely bent out of shape over the good or the bad, just more of a calmness about it. I'll let it go at that. Thanks.
Yeah. Good. Thanks, Kathy. Yeah, like you said this morning, in equanimity, right? Good. Listen, there's one other thing that I wanted to point out in here. I thought it was really interesting where he talked about the father in South Africa, I think is where he was talking about, who bought the funeral insurance and then made this big ceremony about giving it to his son. Yeah, that whole thing was funny about how much they spend on funerals and that sort of thing. But this ceremony about giving it to his son, and he asked himself, you know, what's the ceremony about? And it's about the obvious replacement of value, because if they took that money and spent it on insurance, there's going to be less food, less soap, less, you know, necessities. So there needed to be a ritual, a ceremony in, you know, this is the value that has been replaced with. And I think that that can also be helpful to us on our path of awakening. Well, I know it can. And we're instructed to remember that. And we talked about that this morning. It's about replacing those doubt thoughts, those self-limiting, self-doubt thoughts with our daily bread. And it's the same thing because of our loss aversion, because we hate losing more than we enjoy gaining. We need to feed ourselves this, right? This thought, the thought of the day, this insight that we've gotten from inner wisdom, to remind ourselves that we're not, it feels like loss, you know, I can't get my way, as if that were possible anyway. That feels like loss, and that needs to be replaced with something. That's why you can't just, it replaces that imagined value that we've given to these habitual ways of being with true value. But it's important to make that replacement just because that's how we're wired. That's how our minds work. George.
Yeah, I had actually watched that TED Talk before, and as I was watching it, I was thinking, well, we've already seen this, but we didn't. I did. So I did have a hard time relating to how this is related to spiritual awakening. But he did say one thing there: to change behavior, change the environment. You know, for though most of us went to some sort of traditional church, and their message was one of fear. You know, if you don't do this, you're going to lose out. You're going to lose out big time. So that was, you know, and society tells us all the time, if you don't do this, you're going to lose. You know, I was an investor for many, many years. I've let that go. You know, there's two reasons that people don't do well in the market. One is fear of loss. And then the greed of gain. You know, when the market's going up, you want to stay in it, even when you logically know that it's not going to go up forever. The fear of loss is when your market starts going down, you sell out because you're afraid you're going to lose more. And from a standpoint of spirituality, that's been the primary message of the world, is fear. If you don't do this, worse things, bad things are going to happen. So that was kind of what I got out of it. It was an interesting study. Now, his study primarily, as I was listening to it, was how do you motivate other people? But let me get back to the change behavior, change environment. We are, with Awakening Together, in the perfect environment to change our behavior. And I know some of us are drug kicking and screaming, but coming back, we have changed that environment. That's all.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, George. I'm sure you weren't referring to me when you said kicking and screaming. that's great. Sharon.
You know, I always like sit and contemplate, not always, but I mean, just contemplate, like, because this has come to me in so many teachings, that if there's no me really, then who is it that wakefulness wakes up? And our practice is important so we can have a better, you know, it just makes us feel better. But I think awakening is, at least I don't know, like I'd love to know from you, Jacqueline, if we're being lived, then who is the I that's doing this, except that we're being like, I can't not be in this process. I'm in this process completely because I'm drawn to it. But other people are totally not. Now, that's not their fault. It's like somebody votes for Trump and somebody votes the Democratic Party. I don't think these people are doing it on purpose. I just think it's all political money. So I don't know. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't know. I can say that the story that's told in NTI is, and a similar story is told in A Course in Miracles, we were curious, you know, what would it be like if it weren't like it was? Okay, now we've had that experience, but we dug ourselves so far in that we've forgotten, right, what our true desire is. And our true desire is to know our fullness, is to live without limitation. And so what all we're coming to do is to recognize our true desire.
Right. And but
that's
I don't think
all we're doing here.
The desire is there. But for me, being in the present and having a happy dream, that's what I really want right now. Now, I know Regina's coming on next. I'm not really ready for that teaching yet, okay? It's not because I don't love Regina. I always listen to Regina myself. But that teaching, and I said this, I think I said this to Dawn, that teaching's not where I am. I'm still gradually seeing. I know the truth. I know the boundless awareness, but I still feel, I still get scared when she goes to that second awakening, you know. And I actually wrote Liz Cronkite, and she has a reading on that. Like, in other words, you know, I guess you got to be where you're at, you know, because you're being moved. You're being, you know, and not to be upset. Like, this is how I am still. I still want to make sure that Regina knows that it's not her. That it's totally me. She would already know that because she knows that. I guess I want to know. Anyway, I thought, but I do like the visit, so I'm here now. Okay.
Thank you, Sharon, for sharing. I, you know, I don't know if anybody has anything that they want to say to address that. You know, I certainly, I get the fear of the second awakening, and I would have to say that that's because of what I'm identified with, right? I mean, if you're telling me you're going to disappear, I don't want to disappear, right? I want to be here forever. You're going to make me disappear? No, thank you. So I think that's probably a lot of where that comes from, don't you?
Absolutely. That was so helpful.
Oh, good. Awesome. Good. I see Dawn. Dawn.
I just want to speak to this because I had this when we're, you know this, Jacqueline, remember when you first
I do. Don freaked out.
Audio because I was freaking out. And it's so hilarious. But I would love to use myself as an example today. This is how the ego, we are tricked or duped by the ego. Like, look and see how I misinterpreted what love was for so long, trying to avoid these feelings that I mistakenly thought were something else. The second that I see it as it really is, there's just this huge breakthrough, pure acceptance. And now I see, if this ever comes up again in this feeling, which knowing me, we know it will. And now I can see it that it's a treasure. It's to be respected and nourished. And it's not something to push away, but this could be like how we look at the awakening. Like, we're looking at all these different stages of awakening as if, oh, no, I don't want that. That's too scary. But that's exactly, I'm using myself as an example, that's exactly what I was doing with these feelings. No, that's way too scary. But the second that I was like, no, I really want to know the truth, Holy Spirit, please, no matter what the answer is, I want to know. And then look, it was like one of the, probably the biggest mind-blowing breakthroughs. I mean, I never would have thought the answer that came through today. And look, I'm still here. The joy and happiness, like this big giant thing has been lifted off of me. I know I say that a lot, but my God, that's exactly how it feels. To feel the lightness that I can finally accept this part of me that has actually been beautiful all along. And I think this is how the awakening is going to be. It's when it falls away, like what fell away today for me was just a misinterpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And do I feel a loss at that loss? Well, heck no. So maybe that's how it's going to be.
That's brilliant, Dawn. Is it really lost if what I'm losing is my confusion? Yeah. Yeah, that's all. No, that's all that, exactly. That's all that's at
root. I almost feel like I could touch the roof. Like, it feels like there's helium inside of me, and I just want to, like, I want to be up there, you know? It's like, I'm so happy.
And I also really appreciate Dawn, and I typed it on the board earlier when you said it, but I want to reiterate it here. You asked today inner wisdom for truth at any cost. I don't care what the actual answer is, just what is the truth. And it's that type of motivation that will spur us on beyond our proclivities towards laziness and loss aversion and all these things we talk about, and the habitual ways of thinking and programming. It's that type of motivation. Give me truth at any cost that will carry us on that journey. So I think that's an excellent demonstration, Dawn. Thank you for sharing. Let's see what time it is. What time does my thing say? It is 4 minutes till. So I'm going to ask those of you who are here if you have anything else you want to share before we go. I have to tell you that my heart just fills up when I'm here with you guys. So really, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
You help a lot of us, Jacqueline. You really do, because you're so, you know, you've been doing it so long, and it's just, it's good for me to hear these things, you know, because I don't know, where can you go and discuss these things?
Right here, that's right.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm going to go, and I'll listen to this woman when I'm down further.
This Mormon, not Regina. You mean Bernadette, right?
That's what I meant, right? But the thing is, like, even knowing I'm awareness and I walk in that, it's still in the intellect. It yeah. can't be in my being, or else I wouldn't be afraid.
Yeah.
So,
I get
anyway,
that.
See you guys, and I listen to you on my own all week. Bye.
Okay, and I'm going to let go of the mic too. Bye, everybody. I love you. And I will see you next time.